Today is Tuesday, April 27th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Gino Dorfo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, U.S. pushes for immediate pullout of Eritrean forces in Tigray.
We are gravely concerned about the deteriorating humanitarian crisis in Tigray and the reports of human rights abuses, violations, and atrocities.
Also, fighting erupts in eastern Myanmar.
Heavy fighting erupted in Myanmar along the eastern border with Thailand on Tuesday.
Plus, Somali Prime Minister calls for calm after overnight clashes. These stories and more are next. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken has pressed Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed for troops from Eritrea involved in the Tigray conflict to be withdrawn, quote, immediately, in full and in a verifiable manner, unquote. Blinken said Eritrean forces and Amhara regional forces in the Tigray region are contributing to the growing humanitarian disaster and committing human rights abuses, according to a statement. Washington said last week that it had seen no evidence of a troop withdrawal promised by both Ethiopia and Eritrea. State Department spokesman Ned Price.
We remain, of course, committed to building an enduring partnership with the Ethiopian people, and we remain committed to the territorial integrity and unity of Ethiopia. All that said, we are gravely concerned about the deteriorating humanitarian crisis in Tigray and the reports of human rights abuses, violations, and atrocities that have emanated from there. This administration has encouraged international partners, including the AU and regional partners, to work with us to address the crisis in Tigray, including through action at the UN and other relevant bodies. Now, of course, we have heard statements emanate from the region. We have heard the Eritrean government's public statement that it will withdraw its forces from Tigray, but that must still be implemented in practice. There is no evidence that such a withdrawal is underway.
That's State Department spokesman Ned Price. Today, Blinken begins what's been called a virtual tour of Africa with video meetings with the presidents of Nigeria and Kenya. President Joe Biden said, quote, war in Afghanistan was never meant to be a multi-generational undertaking, unquote, and announced that the United States will begin its final troop withdrawal from Afghanistan by May 1st and complete it by September 11th of this year. President Biden said the U.S. will continue to support the government of Afghanistan and provide assistance to the Afghan National Defenses and Security Forces. David DeRoche, an associate professor at the Near East Southeast Center for Strategic Studies, discuss the development with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi.
Well, I think it's probably the right decision, but it was made in the wrong manner. Everything we can do in Afghanistan, we probably have done. Everything we're willing to do in Afghanistan, we've probably done. And if we haven't enabled the Afghan government to stand on its own, albeit with significant support at a distance, in 20 years, then we're not going to be able to do it. But the problem is, if you announce that you're going to leave the country, which is the aim of the Taliban, and then say, okay, let's start negotiations, what you've done is demoralized your partners in the Afghan government, which is a legitimate democratically elected government. And you've deprived the Taliban of any motivation to make any concessions. They'll just say, oh, we'll just wait you out and then we'll get what we want. So it's probably the right move, but the way it was handled, I think, has given aid and comfort to the Taliban and will really undermine morale among our Afghan partners.
NATO allies have promised to match the U.S. action and withdraw around 7,000 of their troops from Afghanistan. From a strategic point of view, what could that lead to?
Well, that's a really good question. So, you know, NATO is in Afghanistan, but it can't really stay there without the U.S. backbone. And we've known that, you know, from the start. I mean, I was at the NATO defense ministerial when it was agreed that the partners would take a role as NATO in Afghanistan. But it was clear then that they expected significant American support. So with the United States withdrawing, it really isn't practical for NATO to remain. What's really interesting about this is that this announcement was made without consultation with NATO. So this is the kind of stuff that Donald Trump was criticized for. The NATO Secretary General, who's trying to push through a very ambitious NATO reform agenda, found out about this from reporters and had his knees cut out from under him. And the reports that I'm getting from Brussels are that he was very, very upset over this. So, you know, the NATO role, again, was not handled well. It's probably the right move. I think the allies are getting tired of having a perpetual presence in Afghanistan, but it could have been handled better, and it probably should have been handled better.
While the U.S. will not stay involved in Afghanistan militarily, President Biden made clear that the U.S. will continue to support the government of Afghanistan and provide assistance to the Afghan national defenses and security forces. Would that be enough to enable the government to secure Afghanistan?
Well, I don't know. The devil is in the details. But I think that it should give them a fighting chance. The metaphor that people are making here is the U.S. withdrawal from Vietnam. But basically, South Vietnam was invaded by a conventional army from North Vietnam. The Taliban is not that. The Taliban is a rural, locally based organization that is primarily concentrated among one of Afghanistan's many ethnic groups. So, you know, if the U.S. forces withdraw, particularly if we're continuing to provide technical, financial, and equipment aid to the Afghan forces, chances are pretty good they'll continue to operate. And they should be able to do it well in most parts of the country. They will be at a disadvantage in Pakhtun areas of the country, which is where the Taliban draws its support from. But a more likely scenario is not the Taliban running into and taking Kabul. It's that you have a descent into sort of a factionalized Afghanistan.
That's David DeRoche, Associate Professor at the Near East Southeast Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with my colleague, Mohammed Al-Shanawi. Fighting erupted in Myanmar near the Thai border earlier on Tuesday as ethnic minority Karen insurgents attacked an army outpost in some of the most intense clashes since the February 1st coup plunged Myanmar into crisis. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
Heavy fighting erupted in Myanmar along the eastern border with Thailand on Tuesday. Villagers said they saw heavy gunfire before sunrise at a Myanmar military outpost in an area that is largely controlled by Karen ethnic minority fighters. Later, the Karen National Union, Myanmar's oldest rebel force, said it had captured the army position. The fighting is one of the most intense clashes in Myanmar since the military launched a coup earlier this year and plunged the country into crisis. Karen groups say 24,000 people have been displaced by conflict in recent weeks, including airstrikes by Myanmar's air force. Elsewhere in Myanmar, there have been relatively few reports of bloodshed since the weekend meeting between junta leader Min Aung Hlaing and Southeast Asian leaders. But protests have continued against the junta, with calls for education staff and students to boycott. Activists have also criticised the meeting of ASEAN, saying it helped legitimise the junta.
That's Libby Hogan of Reuters. India continues to suffer the worst surge of coronavirus cases since the pandemic began, with daily numbers rising to new heights with each passing day. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
India remains the global hotspot. Not only hospitals, but now crematoriums and burial grounds are being overwhelmed. The surge has depleted oxygen supplies to critical levels, leaving many patients to die while waiting to see doctors.
It's a terrible situation.
President Biden's chief medical advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci, tells ABC's This Week several measures are being considered.
Oxygen supplies, drugs, tests, PPE.
The administration is also looking to help with vaccines.
Both immediately now, as well as in the situation where you help them to be able to essentially make vaccines themselves.
The White House says it's identified sources and will make available the raw material India needs to make the Covishield vaccine. Ben Thomas, Washington.
At least two people were killed and 27 injured in Chad on Tuesday as demonstrators took to the streets demanding a return to civilian rule after the military took control following President Idris Deby's death last week. Military leaders have named a prime minister, but the opposition has complained that they have no right and called for protests. David Doyle of Reuters has more.
Chad's new military leaders named a civilian politician as prime minister of a transitional government on Monday. But the appointment was swiftly dismissed by opposition leaders. Albert Paimi Padake was named prime minister a week after the battlefield death of President Idris Deby. Padake was seen as a Deby ally and previously served as prime minister from 2016 to 2018. Following Deby's death, a military council, headed by his son Mahamat Idris Deby, took control. Opposition leaders have called the takeover a coup, and two of them said on Monday that the military council has no right to pick a prime minister. Despite Padake's appointment, the council is still likely to be the ultimate authority. But it's also coming under international pressure to hand over power to civilians as soon as possible. The African Union has expressed grave concern over the military takeover. Former colonial power France and some of Chad's neighbours are pushing for a military-civilian solution. A coalition of civil society groups and opposition politicians has called for a peaceful protest on Tuesday to demand a return to constitutional order. The military council has promised an 18-month transition to elections as it fights off a rebel offensive. At the weekend, the military rejected an offer from the Front for Change and Concord in Chad for a ceasefire and talks. The rebel group poured over Chad's northern border 2 weeks ago and vowed to march on the capital N'Djamena, but have been pushed back by the army. The Air Force has since bombarded rebel positions, the military and rebels said. Chad's military council rejected negotiations, saying the, quote, outlaws needed to be tracked down and arrested for their role in Deby's death.
The U.S. State Department hailed the appointment of a new prime minister and said the administration is closely monitoring the situation in the country, but also called for national dialogue and a peace transition to a, quote, civilian-led government, unquote. This is the Voice of America. A remotely piloted boat packed with explosives has targeted the Saudi port of Yanbu in the Red Sea. That's according to Saudi Arabia, whose military said it destroyed the boat. The blast off the coast sent black smoke into the sky. Private maritime security firm Dryad Global said it had reports that the ship had been, quote, attacked, unquote, possibly an oil tanker, but that has not been confirmed. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Somali Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Robo has called for calm and dialogue after overnight clashes in the capital between backers and opponents of President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, known as Farmajo. Analysts worry the political standoff over parliament's term extension for Farmajo could quickly turn into an armed conflict. Mohamed Kahiye reports from Mogadishu.
Roble says he was saddened by overnight violence in the capital, Mogadishu, between the government security agencies and forces from the opposition. He added that dialogue and understanding are the only ways to resolve the stalemate. Clashes were reported at the home of opposition Wadajir party leader Abdulrahman Abishakur and at the home of former President Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud. The former president is among those who oppose Farmajo's term extension. Somali opposition leaders have blamed Farmajo and security forces for the fighting, but Security Minister Hassan Hundube denies the accusations and blames the opposition. The crisis is related to delayed elections. Somalia's parliamentary and presidential elections have been held up for months because of disputes over the electoral process. The stalemate took a new turn this month after the lower house of parliament voted to extend the mandate of President Farmajo's government for 2 years. Opposition lawmakers who were already against Farmajo's staying in office strongly rejected the move, as the international community also warned against its effect on Somalia's stability. Mohamed Hassan Idris, a member of opposition party, says the government is not ready for dialogue due to its actions regarding the violence in the capital.
His appreciation of the operation by the security forces, clarifying that he isn't calling to calm the situation, instead he's encouraging the ongoing illegal operation that aim to secure the unconstitutional extension.
The African Union last week urged Somali leaders to resume the election talks, rejecting the extension of Farmajo's mandate. Its envoy is expected to visit Somalia in the next coming weeks. Afyar Elmi is the Associate Professor of Security Studies at Qatar University. He says dialogue is the only way out to avoid armed clashes seen in Mogadishu on Sunday.
I think there is only one way out of the situation at the moment, and that is to go back to the negotiating table and resolve the political conflict and the election issues that have triggered the violence in the first place.
The UN office in Somalia urges maximum restraint by all parties, while calling on all sides to immediately resume dialogue. Mohamed Kahiye for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
Turkey put more than 100 senior members of the country's main pro-Kurdish HDP party on trial Monday, prompting concerns and protests from international human rights groups. For VOA, Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
108 prominent members of Turkey's pro-Kurdish HDP went on trial in the capital Ankara Monday in connection with violent nationwide protests in 2014 that left 37 people dead. The protests were against the government's failure to militarily intervene as the Islamic State was poised to overrun the predominantly Syrian Kurdish town of Kobani on Turkey's border. Speaking outside the courthouse Monday, HDP co-chair Mithat Sancar said the trial is politically motivated. A party official called this a case of revenge, which he said is the product of the defeats that the HDP has made the government suffer. Ankara accuses the YPG, Syrian Kurdish fighters defending Kobani, of being terrorists, no different from the Islamic State militants. The government is vigorously defending the prosecution, claiming the defendants have to be held to account for the deaths in the 2014 unrest. But Emma Sinclair Webb of the New York-based Human Rights Watch says the case is part of an alarming trend.
This is an entirely political trial, as so many trials in Turkey are these days. This is part of a continuous effort to deplete the HDP, to criminalize it. Basically, the evidence is based on political speeches, and there is just no compelling, credible evidence to pursue this case.
The defendants face life sentences on charges of murder, insurrection and inciting terrorism. Among those on trial is the HDP's two former leaders who are already in jail. The ruling AK party accuses the HDP of being linked to the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK, which is fighting the Turkish state, a charge the party denies. Columnist Sezin Öner of the Duvar news portal says the future of the party is now in doubt.
Probably the beginning of the end for HDP. AK Party officials in various instances have mentioned that their intention is to wipe out HDP for good so that it cannot make a comeback.
Dozens of the elected HDP mayors are already in jail, and advocates fear that prosecutors could be preparing what is designed to be a fatal blow to Turkey's second largest opposition party. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
China has said that Australia must abide by its, quote, one China, unquote, policy after senior government officials in Canberra warned of conflict over Taiwanese independence. Under the policy, the Chinese Communist Party asserts sovereignty over Taiwan. Defense Minister Peter Dutton said a military confrontation involving China over Taiwan, quote, should not be discounted, unquote, but he has insisted Australia's focus remain on having, quote, good relations, unquote, with Beijing. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Relations between Australia and China, its most valuable trading partner, are at their worst in decades. There have been trade and political tensions, as well as disagreements over human rights. Canberra's call last year for an inquiry into the origins of the coronavirus, which was first detected in China in 2019, offended Beijing. It interpreted Australia's demand as criticism of its handling of the pandemic. Bilateral ties have deteriorated ever since. There is now friction over Taiwan. It's seen by Beijing as a breakaway province that will eventually be reunified with the Chinese mainland under what it calls the One China policy. Australia doesn't recognise Taiwan as a sovereign state or regard the authorities in Taiwan as a national government. However, the United States has raised concerns about Chinese aggression towards Taiwan. US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has asserted that Washington has a serious commitment to Taiwan being able to defend itself. When asked on national television, Australia's Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton wouldn't rule out a military confrontation.
I don't think it should be discounted. I think China has been very clear about the reunification, and that's been a long-held objective of theirs. And if you look at any of the rhetoric that's coming out of China from spokesmen, particularly in recent weeks and months, in response to different suggestions that have been made, they've been very clear about that goal.
In response, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Wang Wenbin had this message for Canberra.
澳联邦政府无力否决维州政府同中方签署的一带一路合作协议.
Abiding by the One China principle is a prerequisite for China-Australia relations. Taiwan is an inalienable part of China's territory, and the Taiwan issue is purely China's internal affairs that involves China's core interests and allows no foreign interference. Last week, Australia abandoned deals made with the state of Victoria, linked to China's Belt and Road Initiative. Observers say the billions worth of infrastructure investment projected by the Chinese government aims to expand its global economy and influence. But the project has left some countries with significant debt. Officials in Canberra said it was protecting Australia's national interest. But the Chinese embassy in Australia called the move provocative. Analysts believe that Canberra is being punished for trying to stand up to China, which has imposed restrictions and tariffs on a range of Australian farming goods as well as coal. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
While some mosques have opened to prayer during this second Ramadan during the COVID-19 pandemic, religious studies continue online. And in at least one mosque near Washington, D.C., a local teen is trying to keep the lessons entertaining and engaging, as VOA's Dania Iman reports.
Abstaining from food and drink is challenging enough for adults during Ramadan, but for children, it can be more so, especially in the crucial hours before the breaking of the fast at sundown.
Those few hours before Maghrib time comes along, so they can just forget about it for just a little bit.
Safiya Salahuddin is a 17-year-old Muslim Indonesian American who lives in Reston, Virginia, just outside the U.S. Capitol. Every night ahead of sundown, she hosts Story Time with Safiya, a half-hour interactive program retelling stories from the Muslim holy book, the Quran. It's aimed at children ages 6 to 10 in the Washington, D.C. area, like 6-year-old Sophia in Herndon.
Very good. I like how she can, ask us questions and we can answer them. And also I like how we can also raise our hands.
Young children may not be fasting for almost 15 hours as most adult Muslims are on the continental U.S., but many parents want their kids to familiarize themselves with fasting and also with religious studies during the holy month.
Karena anak saya itu sedang belajar berpuasa.
My daughter is still learning to fast, so while we wait for the call to prayer, she can attend this positive activity. She loves being read stories by Safiya about the Prophet's companions and other stories in the Quran.
Story Time with Safiya is one of the online learning programs facilitated by Imam Center, a mosque and community center in Silver Spring, Maryland.
We jumped at the opportunity. This is a very brilliant idea for children aged 6 to 10 to have them participate in activities during Ramadan.
Safiya Salahuddin herself is a Girl Scout and has had experience with children before.
I am the oldest of four. So I have experience handling my younger siblings, and also I volunteer in madrasa.
She admits children can get easily distracted in online learning and that she herself may have lost communication skills during the pandemic. But through her night story time, she hopes to entertain, educate, and engage her young audience as they await the breaking of the fast. In Reston, Virginia, Dania Iman, VOA.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening and have